the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and we will discuss how in the last 2 weeks China and the United States have been advancing distinct and separate defence alliances. On the one hand, the United States has been building up a coalition of allies that appears designed to contain China's presence in the South China Sea. On the other hand, China has been cementing its defence and trade ties with adversaries of the United States. The pacts include formal cooperation status with Iran and also the Russian Federation. So what makes the last 2 weeks different from the last 4 years? Are we witnessing the emergence of some sort of 21st century version of the Cold War, a kind of Cold War II-styled standoff in a post-Trump world? If so, where does that leave small powers like New Zealand and a host of other economies that make up the states of the Asia-Pacific region? So let's cross to Paul to dig into this most important issue. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Zellin.
Yeah, Paul, now we've seen in the last 2 weeks a lot of activity around the South China Sea. We'll go to the video clips in a moment, but what do you make of this? Is this opportunism that is taking place within the Western powers against China? Remember, we're on the back of a trade war that's been between the United States and China for some time. Australia's been caught in what it calls the crosshairs of that. And is it opportunistic for China to once and for all start to assert its might? How do you read the situation right now, Paul?
Well, I think the backdrop is twofold. On the one hand, there is the United States has a new administration, and it has to reassert its position on foreign policy and international affairs. And obviously, China is front and center in any U.S. foreign policy approach these days. So that is going on the one hand. On the other hand, though, we have to remember that this year is the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. And so it's a big deal in China. And what we have in the last few weeks, we've seen what you might call dueling foreign policy junkets. Secretary of State Antony Blinken went out and basically reassured a host of allies that the United States is not going anywhere, that it's in fact going to recommit to various alliance structures. And on the other hand, President Jinping Xi, has gone on an extended junket to celebrate the 100th anniversary. And he signed a number of deals, as you mentioned, with a host of states whose commonality rests in two things. One, antipathy towards the United States, and two, autocratic leadership. And that is interesting because the United States, the Biden administration, have now said that the international system is basically divided between autocrats and democrats. And the future of the international system will be in that competition between autocracy and democracy, whereas the Chinese are saying that basically they are there to represent the end of the post-colonial legacy where Western interests dominated all forms of international discourse, and that now is the time for the post-colonial world, led by China, to finally assert its supremacy in the face of Western decline. And quite frankly, it's hard to argue against that.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? So Paul, so the audience gets an idea of exactly what has been happening in the previous 2 weeks, or even going back to the beginning of March. I'll just let's just run through a timeline of reportage that has been occurring specifically about China, the South China Sea, the United States' response to that, countries like the Philippines, countries like Taiwan, how they're responding to this very strong presence that China is advancing. So just bringing up here, and we'll let's kick this off.
Beijing is stepping up its presence in the South China Sea. The Chinese government has maneuvered hundreds of militia ships into the disputed waters, effectively blocking access for the maritime activities of other nations. A report in the New York Times says China is attempting to, quote, accomplish by overwhelming presence what it has been unable to do through diplomacy or international law. China's recent moves come after they built and fortified, with military bases, a series of man-made islands in the region starting in 2014.
And also, Paul, what we're seeing here also, going back to the beginning of March, so that was CBS News, obviously, citing the New York Times reportage. We go back a month, we go back to the beginning of March, and Australia's Sky News broadcast, and remember, Australia senses that it's in the crosshairs of any conflict that potentially could develop between China and the Western powers. Remember, China has been hitting back at Australian interests through its trade dependency kind of avenues. So that remember, and China is well and truly ahead of Japan as Australia's most significant and top trading partner. Now, in the beginning of March, Australia's Sky News broadcast a 24-minute special report, as it said, and it headlined, political leaders in Australia have warned there is a credible threat that tensions with China could lead to a dirty war. I'll just play the beginning of this clip so you can get an idea of what is happening inside China, what the media inside China is developing a narrative on.
Political leaders in Australia have warned there is a credible threat that tensions with China could lead to a deadly war. The world has been crippled by coronavirus, which was first identified in Wuhan and sent countries into a grinding economic halt. As America attempts to beat COVID-19 for good and spends trillions supporting its citizens, the next threat is growing in the background: China. In this special report, Sky News explores the terrifying threat of conflict with China, democracy's attempt to hinder the communist titan, and the worries over the capacity of President Joe Biden to prevent Beijing from achieving its plan for world leadership and the takeover.
And also, what we've seen immediately prior to that report, Paul, there was a special report also that came out over a half an hour in its duration by Australia's ABC's News in Depth program. And it broadcast on March the 1st. So that was the first off the thing. And it headlined Xi Jinping, China's president, in his quest for world power. So it's starting to, you know, it really kicked off the narrative on this in Australia.
No one in the world today, anywhere in any other country, is more powerful than President Xi Jinping.
He's declared himself chairman for life. I call him chairman of everything, chairman of everywhere, chairman of everyone.
So Paul,
hitch yourself to that wagon.
I'll just turn that audio down.
What a TV.
Chairman for life. I call him chairman of
everything. Chairman of everything. It's just reversed back to that that Australian line there. So, you know, last week, Paul, you and I were discussing symbolism and exactly, you know, how nations develop a narrative within their countries and sending signals both internally, domestically, but also externally on all sorts of different of tiers, if you like. Since those two documentaries ran in Australia, we've seen tensions heating up, particularly amongst between the United States allies and China itself. We've seen reportage in the South China Sea, for example, the South China Morning Post, so from China's point of view, kind of saying that the Philippines in this whole kind of configuration is probably too sensible to fall into what the China press says is being duped by Western powers. But the whole sense of this is it's heating up. The most recent reports overnight, for example, even have Taiwan, the foreign minister, let's see if I can bring this up, talking about using the word war and that they would fight to the very end if they had to.
China is once again playing the aggressor card, intimidating its neighbors and flexing its military muscle. In the latest in a series of provocations, China has increased its forays into Taiwanese airspace, but Taiwan isn't backing down. Taiwan's foreign minister says the island nation will fight to the end if China attacks.
Our defense ministry is very determined in defending ourselves. We are willing to defend ourselves, and it's without any question. And we will fight the war if we need to fight the war, and if we need to, to defend ourselves to the very last day, we will defend ourselves to the very last day.
If we start to consider from symbols coming out of these countries, Paul, I get a sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, that things, the tensions, the heat around this is building up. Can you take us through this and how security analysts would be viewing this that represent respective countries, and also how you see the whole thing in its reality in the last 2 weeks as compared to perhaps under the Trump administration's last 4 years?
Well, let's take a broader view. I'll try to synthesize it really quickly. So basically, we're in a transitional moment in international affairs, where we move from a bipolar world during the Cold War to a unipolar world dominated by the United States in the 1990s to an emerging multipolar world today. And these things take time, and they're characterized by the jostling for position in the new world order between ascendant and declining powers. And so one might argue the United States is a declining power. It certainly is no longer the superpower that it used to be, if for no other reason than the presence of China as now a peer competitor across the spectrum of endeavor. So something is emerging. We don't know exactly yet. We know that India will be a great power that's part of this mix. Unfortunately, Brazil was mentioned early on as part of the BRICS, and it has now fallen by the wayside, and I don't think it will recover for two decades. From the Bolsonaro administration. Germany may come back, Japan may come back, Australia may emerge. So the multipolar world is emerging. Now, what's interesting about that is two things. The first is that in transitional moments, international norms, rules, mores, law are basically the exception to the rule. By definition, transitions mean looseness in the affairs of state. And so adherence to international norms and law is at a premium. It's not like during status quo times when everybody adheres to the status quo. So you have norm violation, porousness, if you will, on the one hand, and then you have conflict as the system's regulator. And that conflict can be economic, diplomatic, or military. Oftentimes, economic and diplomatic conflict is a substitute for direct military conflict, given the consequences. But what we're seeing today is a jostling of position between China and the U.S. alliance. And again, I think it's very interesting because in international relations theory, it was generally assumed that when you had a transitional moment moving to multipolarity, the situation was akin to the invisible hand of the market, that powers would emerge pursuing their national interests and a new status quo would develop based on their relative power to each other. And they would form alliances based on specific interests. They would switch sides depending on, again, specific national interests, and that the combination of these great powers jockeying for position would actually lead to stability over the longer term.
And that we're seeing something different now. Yeah.
We are. And that I think, is the unforeseen part of this. And it is fascinating, although alarming, is we have now attempts by the two great powers, the United States and China, to try to fashion this emerging multipolar world in their own preferred image. So the United States wants to say it's all about democracy against autocracy. And we are the leaders of the democratic world the way we were during the Cold War. They're harking back to that, and you mentioned it, it's Cold War 2.0. On the other hand, and I find the Chinese position fascinating, is that they're saying, look, since the colonial era, the West has dominated the international system. The rules are made by the West. The West has exploited everybody to its own advantage. They talk about democracy, but in fact, they're neither really democratic at home, much less abroad. And of course, during that bilateral between the United States and China, references to George Floyd and BLM were mentioned. So the Chinese are saying, we're not leading a coalition of autocracies. We're leading a coalition of post-colonial states who refuse to bend the knee in front of the Western powers. It's time for a reshuffling of the deck. And that is both interesting from an international relations standpoint and highly alarming, because what it means is the possibility of confrontation between these two emerging blocks, because that's exactly what we're seeing now, is two emerging blocks, not the invisible hand, but the orchestrated construction of two blocks that see each other as hostile rivals and are entering into competition across the full spectrum of relations, economic to military.
And we see China clearly is in its ascendancy, both, you know, from the point of view of its political presence, its footprint of claim extending out beyond its borders, its economic might, its development as a machine, if you like. And if you, people picked up what Xi Jinping was saying to people, that nothing will stop the development of the Chinese people. And that, you know, he's applauding their hard work as he went down that boulevard, if that's the correct term, and saluting his soldiers. Let's just peel this back, and you hit on something that was really interesting, and it was basically, if I boil it down to, was self-interest. We all know that when we buy an Apple computer or anything, basically, that has been manufactured and assembled, many of the parts and even the assembly of such things often is taking place inside China. The interdependency of what we have considered in the West to be product and normality often is made possible because of the labor force inside China. What kind of effect does that have if we are correct in observing that we're seeing two distinct ally and axis type of bipolar type of arrangements in the world? Where are we in 2 years' time from this?
Well, that's very interesting, because there are issues with China. I mean, we've talked about this. I think that some of the Chinese power projection is due to some insecurities on the part of the CCP leadership at home. Remember, they have now negative birth rates. They've flattened out. So in terms of being, you know, the huge country with the manpower that they've had until now, because of their rising standards of living and whatnot, they're starting to develop bourgeois lifestyles, which means, among other things, not having a lot of kids. Mm. Now, there is something,
and of course, there was the one-child policy, of which changed most recently. So obviously, they identified the demographic changes, you know, relating to birth, and have applied policy in that respect, trying to keep up, yeah?
You know, we could do a whole sidebar on why their attempts to secularize the Uyghur have led to this genocide, because the Uyghur are reproducing at much higher rates than Han Chinese are. But let me say this, because I think that especially for us sitting down here in the South Pacific watching this play, there's something we need to keep firmly in mind. And this is a word to the wise when it comes to foreign policy makers in New Zealand and Australia, although they seem a far gone. We have to beware of the great dichotomy, or better said, the false dichotomy, where foreign policy is turned by its elites into an all or nothing, either or, black or white proposition. I'll give you a historical example. In the early 1950s, late 40s, early 1950s, US foreign policy establishment was run by two brothers, the Dulles brothers. One was the CIA chief, the other was the Secretary of State. And they constructed a narrative that the United States was in an essential war against communism, and that everything everywhere was about the fight against communism. And what that led to was the United States trampling the legitimate interests of people in Africa, people in Asia, people in Latin America, under the guise of fighting communism. Now, if we look at today, on the one hand, the United States wants to reclaim its position under that liberal internationalist mantra that Joe Biden happens to subscribe to, which is that the United States is the leader of the free world. Free world means democracy and free markets, and China is the enemy of both of those things. On the other hand, China has nationalistic reasons to want to be able to rally its people in this great power projection project. What I'm saying here is that the antagonism, the bipolarity, may be more of an artificial construction of the foreign policy elites in both countries than it is a reality on the ground. And you just mentioned it. If most of the world depends on Chinese labor for consumer durables and non-durables, then certainly it's not a bipolar situation. It's a little more complex than that. And severing those ties will hurt everybody. So I have a feeling that, not that we're being played, but that the foreign policy elites of both of these great powers are captured by their own imaginations of the other. Because if you think about it, that's what they're doing. They're othering the other side. And I'm not entirely sure that reality accords with these visions of the international, the emerging international world as one being divided into two competing blocks.
As countries advance toward conflict and war, we see in our recent history some examples where miscommunication, misunderstandings of the intent of the other side, if you like, have been in evidence. And I'll just make reference there to Robert McNamara in the Fog of War documentary, where he basically says, we misread what Vietnam was all about. We thought it was a fight against communism, of which you're mentioning here. You know, US foreign policy built upon that premise. But in actual fact, we misread the signals from Vietnam that they were fighting for nationhood, that they had had, over the centuries, issues relating identifying themselves as separate to China. We had the French colonization of Vietnam. We had the United States going in, and we know all of that history. And he says, if we only understood, it could have been a different history of which was mapped out. So, you know, there's a very poignant points, aren't they, Paul?
Yeah, and, you know, again, Vietnam was, I hate to say it, but just another post-colonial war. You know, again, I guess you have to live in the third world to sort of see that from the get-go, and McNamara clearly didn't. But let me give you a more recent example to show you how this misperception and the misconstruction of this emerging bipolarity or block polarity, I guess I'd rephrase it. The United States, Japan, Australia, and India have just formed a military alliance that is known as the Quad.
Yeah.
And what is the commonality of these four states? Their main adversary is China. So they say that what they're doing is forming a defensive alliance against Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific. But if you put it in the Chinese perspective, what do they see? They see traditional adversaries, including the Japanese, attempting to ring fence them in their own region. That's bound not to go over well in Beijing.
Particularly, now, you know, particularly with China actually staking serious claim to those islands and the areas of the South China Sea. And in the last 2 weeks, moving hundreds, they're referring to it as a swarm, hundreds of vessels of a private militia, or put inverted commas.
No, it's a Coast Guard militia.
Coast Guard militia. So you'll be able to speak in specific terms to that. And the response from the Philippines, from Australia, from Japan, from the United States most significantly, and sending hardware into that region at a time where China is ratcheting up that presence. All the while, Taiwan, China is having Air Force manoeuvres very close to the border. And this is why, like we brought up just at the beginning of this program, the Taiwanese foreign minister actually seeing this as signals of war, and in his own way saying we're determined as an economy in our own right to actually resist this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the what the Chinese are doing to the Taiwanese is known as saber rattling. They're just waving their sabers around to let the Taiwanese know that this isn't going to get resolved anytime soon. Now, you know, let me just admit my prejudices. I'm not a fan of one-party authoritarian states that systematically violate the human rights of their citizens. So I'm not a fan of China in its present construction, and certainly its behavior with the island building project, which has been deemed illegal under international law. And now the attempt to use swarms of pseudo fishing vessels under the, you know, possession is two-thirds of the law doctrine, you know, quite sticks in my craw, but it's smart. Because what they're doing is, what the Chinese are doing, again, to repeat, in the South China Sea, is action short of war. What are you going to do about a swarm of wooden vessels that appear to be fishing vessels but have armed Coast Guard guys on them encroaching in Filipino waters? Well, that puts the ball in the Philippines' court. What are they going to do? Fire upon these guys? They're doing it all along the littoral margins of the South China Sea. So they're tempting the Malaysians, they're tempting the Vietnamese, although the Vietnamese respond with force. But basically, they're putting the ball in a non-belligerent way, right? Again, no one's firing, you know, weapons at the Filipinos, but saying, look, this is what we're doing. I guess people need to understand, when you put 100 boats of any sort around a small island that has been traditionally used as a fishing outpost by Filipino fishermen, there's no fishing to be done. The noise of the boats and whatnot drives the fish away, and so it's a barren wasteland. So by doing this systematically along the Filipino coastline, they're basically driving the Filipino fishermen either back to shore or further out to sea, which, quite frankly, given that these boats are artisanal fishing boats, they don't have the wherewithal for blue water fishing. So the Chinese are smart that way because, again, they're not firing a shot. And the response is up to the other contending nations. And Philippines is interesting because Duterte has tried to make nice with the Chinese, again, on that anti-colonial principle. Since he doesn't like the United States for a variety of legitimate reasons.
And he's an authoritarian ruler himself.
He's, you know, I mean, again, I don't want to get caught up in the autocrat versus Democrat, but he's clearly an autocrat. But here's the thing. The Chinese have really put the shaft to him because he's trying to make nice with them. And he said, well, as long as you don't encroach in our waters, I don't care what you do with the offshore islands. If you want to militarize them, that's not my business. But now they're arriving within his EEZ. And he may think it's okay, but I'll tell you what, his Navy does not. And he better be, you know, watching his back, because his military, which has a Islamicist insurgency in Mindanao to deal with, are looking at him and going, seriously, you're going to allow encroachment of our sovereign waters just to score points with the Chinese and against the Americans? That may not fly. And so he's not in as secure a position as he thinks. And if he continues to kowtow to the Chinese may lose an ally or a potential ally in the region. Mm. And that brings up one other point, which is the way the Chinese are proceeding, which is at a considerable pace, and now further and further from shore, because remember, in parallel, you have the Belt and Road Initiative. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's a formidable enterprise. Now, I think it's about 8 years in the making. They run the risk of overstretch, of overstepping somewhere. And given that the coalitions that are being built against them, again, the Quad is one of them, but it's not the only one, they run the risk of getting out someplace, getting into a bit of, you know, a bit of strife, and getting slapped down hard, which of course would result in a loss of face for not only President Xi, but for the CCP as a whole. And they definitely don't want that for domestic reasons.
And we've seen, once again, referring back to history, we saw in recent times the United States overstep its ability to sustain the effort inside of Iraq post-invasion. And the domestic pillars, if you like, or the social provision kind of elements of the domestic economy in the United States crumbling. And it's no surprise that all of these years later, one of the biggest political planks of a new presidency is to rebuild the United States' infrastructure inside the boundaries of the United States. So you what you've hit there is right, isn't it? It's about supply lines, supply chains. The Belt and Road Initiative during the COVID year last year, for example, the Chinese, according to the Financial Times, were saying that they were ratcheting back their progress on such things because they were under financial stresses relating to the balance between its investment development banks overseas with potential allies and its own initiative in Belt and Road. So where it is right now, it's anyone's guess, but we're certainly seeing if we're just going to condense this down, the United States building a coalition of ally nations, if you like, outside of its trade self-interest with China. And we're seeing China signing up, as you've identified, like with the Russian Federation, with Iran and others, and developing this particular type of standoff. If we're going to apply that in simple terms to the theory of multipolarity, Paul, where does that take us? What can that show from the point of view of prediction in the next 6 months, 12 months? And where does it leave the smaller powers like New Zealand? Are we in the crosshairs like Australia? Where does it leave the other smaller economies of the ASEAN nations?
Well, the interesting thing is that if we're going to have a flashpoint, that is a flare-up into open military conflict, even if it's relatively small and localized, it's going to happen within a year. Because we're reaching, I guess I should say, when you have a transitional moment and you're moving, especially from a position of unipolarity to multipolarity, the conflict between the jostling ascendant and descendant factions often leads to conflict. And that conflict is almost always started by the declining powers, not by the ascendant powers, because they're about to become the new status quo. So the declining powers fight to maintain what they used to be. World War I is a clear example in that regard. And then the new order emerges out of war. And that's the trouble. The new world order emerges out of war. We could have a flashpoint within the next 6 months to 18 months. That's where I think it'll happen, more than likely in the South China Sea. None of that will be good, but something will be resolved as a result of it. The other thing to remember before we get to the small countries is this thing known as military diplomacy learning curves. The Chinese are smart. They don't sign military alliances with countries. They sign strategic partnerships, which is not only a different phrase, but means we will engage in economic, diplomatic, and then other relationships that we do not mention. And for example, the Chinese have a controlling interest in a major port in Pakistan, a major port in Bangladesh. They have a naval and army base in Djibouti under what is known as the String of Pearls strategy, that has put a military presence along the Indian Ocean into the Middle East. And what it winds up off of Djibouti is their new strategic partner, Iran, which is a full-fledged partner now of the Chinese, which means Chinese interests are at play anytime Iran gets itself in an argument in its own patch of the woods. And so if you think about how the Russians have fought their regional wars in Georgia and Ukraine, this hybrid form of warfare, you can be assured that in the military-military relationship with the Chinese, they are imparting those lessons to their Chinese counterparts. You know, they are less rivals than they are partners against the West. And the Russians are not averse to sharing, especially their success stories, to include Syria, if I want to extend it further afield. What this means for middle powers, this is powers, let's say, like France and the UK. You know, the UK is no longer a great power. Is that they have to be the moderating influence. They have to be, if not the arbitrators, the interlocutors between East and West, between autocrats and democrats, however you want to call it. And unfortunately, the actions of both the United States and the Chinese are forcing them to choose. And a clear example of a choice already been made is Australia. They've chosen a side. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And they're going to pay a price. They would have paid a price one way or another.
And that middle power,
that
middle power, the United Kingdom, Downing Street 3 weeks ago made a lot of noise about its defense strategy to be reconnecting with its interests, basically in the Indo-Pacific region. Specifically, it identified the Southeast Asia region as a defense strategy imperative for it from now going forward. And I kind of wondered at the time whether or not that was the UK realigning with its, you know, it's in the post-Brexit period, and is it nationalistically identifying with where it was prior to the Second World War with respect to the Southeast Asia, its presence in Singapore, et cetera, et cetera? Is it the glory old days? But that aside, this whole thing of self-interest from the point of view of trade, security is taking the forward leap, isn't it? And that's one of the signals of difference here. And certainly if you're relying on middle powers to be a reasoning voice in a world that is deteriorating through the threat of conflict, then it may be that we're losing that opportunity of sanity, do you think?
Yeah, we could be. I mean, you know, let's be clear. Pretty much all of the Western military establishments have reoriented their strategic vision from unconventional conflict and irregular warfare, peacekeeping, that sort of thing, stuff that went on in Afghanistan, to interstate conflict. So peer-to-peer conflict, the old-fashioned way. Big wars between big countries. The French, the Germans, the UK you just mentioned, although anything the UK says in Asia-Pacific needs to be taken with a grain of salt given what happened to Hong Kong. The UK's assurances mean nothing to most of the people in the Asia-Pacific, and we'll see if they can reclaim any position whatsoever. But what is clear everybody is gearing up for interstate warfare. You know, this whole bit about terrorism and whatnot, that's become a sidebar in strategic planning amongst military leaders around the world. And unfortunately, the more you plan for that sort of war, the more likely you're going to get into one because you feel confident that you're going to prevail. And so that's where we get into, you know, the problem of flashpoints, miscalculation, that sort of thing. And all it takes is one-hotted commander on one gray-hulled boat in the South Pacific from whatever side to start a shooting war, and then the escalation possibility is open-ended.
The Sarajevo moment. The Sarajevo moment.
Yeah, you simply do not know. I mean, I would assume cooler heads in national capitals will go, look, we got to cap this thing, because if not, it becomes a military gusher and everybody's going to lose. But we don't know that. We don't know the interests, let's say, within the CCP, who think they can take out the United States, at least as a regional player. We don't know what pressure would be put on Biden by a Republican Congress. Say, look, take them out now before they get any bigger. And we don't know how the Europeans are going to play this. You know, they may want to sit it out. And quite frankly, I don't think either side can prevail if it doesn't have allies to come along with it. And that's where we get involved.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to say, where does it boil down for the small powers? Let's really focus on that. The small powers in the Asia-Pacific region, Southeast Asia region, New Zealand, let's put Australia to the side. Where are they? what would be our response? What would be happening within our Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade at the moment with specific reference to what we are outlining in today's program?
Well, I think they'd realize, and I'll draw the parallel between a truly independent state, Uruguay, okay? Small country, independent, autonomous, all the things we say we are here in New Zealand. Except Uruguay is not tied into a U.S.-led intelligence and military security system. So the Chinese will leave Uruguay alone in the event of a global conflict between it and the United States. They will not leave us alone. We're integral members of the Five Eyes. We spy on them all the time. We're military allies of them and the Australians. We're going to be in the target hairs no matter what. And so, you know, I would say the people at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs fully understand that the best they can do is to get out in front of this and talk about commonalities and what have you, play down the difference in values and culture. And that could well be why the New Zealand government, even though other Western democracies are condemning the Chinese
on human
for their
rights
actions grounds. Against the Uyghur, are trying to finesse it. You know, they may see this as our only hope in the event that push comes to shove, is not only to remain neutral, but to try to assure the Chinese that our national interests are not coterminous or synonymous with those of the United States and Australia. That's our only hope.
On that point, Paul, thank you very much for your company today, and also for those that have joined us live and are seeing this podcast or hearing this podcast once it's on demand. So thank you again. We will be back Thursday around lunchtime New Zealand time, which I think on Eastern Standard Time in the United States around 7 p.m. on a Wednesday there. Until that time, thank you for your company. Take care.